I will paraphrase a quote from Martin Luther that perhaps I should have used yesterday when I was talking about the importance of appealing to all of the senses. Martin Luther said that God created us with five senses. He didn't know about the kinesthetic sense yet, our sixth sense. But he said God created us with five senses, and it would be sheer ingratitude to worship and praise with anything less. Visual sense is one of our most active senses, and is also one of those perhaps that we least overlook in worship compared to the other senses. And yet at the same time, a lot more could be done, and a lot more could be done intentionally. Visual sense has a way of getting used to its surroundings. So when we see the same thing over and over again when we come into church, what we see will wear a rut into our mind, and it no longer affects us. Sometimes we're a little bit careless and we think we have a lot there to appeal to the senses, but for those people who come every Sunday, it's already old, it's already worn, and they don't even notice it. And that is criminal visually. I'm also going to skip over, no, not entirely, I was going to mention some things about the history of visual art and worship. But I found out that one of our artists in the village has a lot of those facts in her head. And so I'm just going to let her take over the microphone and just mention briefly some of the important elements that we're coming to the subject with, some of the past. And I was just going to spend a couple minutes on it, so let's stretch that a little bit, maybe three. Or three and a half.
I wasn't prepared to do all of this. This is coming strictly off the top of my head. It's not been really prepared at all. Phil just approached me recently on this. I guess my background comes as an art major in college, and I taught art in the public schools for many years. And I've always been interested in liturgical art, in visual art, simply
Did
because I'm an
you,
artist.
Marian?
No, you didn't. I'm Marian Junghans, and I teach the course on drawing on the right side of the brain, and that's where I'm at. I'm all pretty much right brain, and that's what we're talking about today. I also do an off loom weaving course. And in the process of going through coursework, you get the history of art, and I've been in, like I say, I mentioned, I'm very interested in liturgical art. And when we look at liturgical art, it goes way, way back. I mean, it's before even Martin Luther's time. It goes way back to the beginning, because as Phil mentioned, seeing is one of the primary, I mean, we don't get around very well unless we see. We all have functional seeing. And this is from day one. And seeing is one way of learning. For those of us who don't have sight, we have a much more difficult time learning what the world is about. We can feel it, we can smell it, we can hear it, we use our other senses. And we develop those other senses to make up for the fact that we don't have sight. But for most of us, sight is a very basic way of absorbing the world around us. And in worship, that environment is absorbed through, one of the ways is through your eyes. I don't delete the fact that there's music and there's other things that enhance your worship. But the eyes are really, really important. Going back clear to medieval days, when the church was the very beginnings of the church, we'll have to take a look at the historical perspective in the knowledge that Gutenberg had not invented the printing press yet. There were very, very few people that could read. The monks were the ones who did the transcriptions, and these are where some of your beautiful Bibles come from, and so forth. But very few people read, and the church felt a real need to teach. I mean, this is what it's all about, is to teach Bible passages and so forth. And the very fact that people could not read meant that they had to do this all within the church itself. And that is the reason that the Catholic Church has had and still continues to have, by history, a lot of statues, a lot of visual things on the outside as well as on the inside. If any of you have ever had the opportunity to visit cathedrals in Europe, you will see these tremendous carvings on the building as you enter. And then on the inside, you're just flooded with visuals. And these visuals are there because people could not read, and they were referred to as part of the teachings. And it took a long, long, well, the church still hangs on to a lot of this visual. Even once the Gutenberg press was in operation and people learned how to read and had their own Bibles, by historically the Catholic Church hung on to a lot of these visuals. And Martin Luther came along, and of course there were a lot of things that he was dumping out of the church, and oftentimes when you get into a reformation, and I'm not making any kind of value judgment here, but oftentimes during a reformation of any kind, you dump out the bathwater and the baby and the tub and you throw everything out. Thank heavens we haven't thrown everything completely out, but we have stripped our Lutheran church of a lot of the visuals that did have meaning at one time. And much to my dismay, I think that we have oftentimes thrown out too much. And now historically we are like this, and we cannot look like the Catholic Church, so we do not take in the visuals that are so prevalent within the church. And I guess I also want to mention, I can't pass this up because I know there's some artists in this group also, that some of the finest artwork in the history of the world was done during these years that all the church, well, the church supported the artists, and they came up with some beautiful things, and beautiful carvings and statues, etc., which is today not so. The church does not support the arts, and it's a whole different ballpark today. But those of us who struggle with liturgical art do so. Most of us are starved for information, for being in contact with each other, and so forth. So this is really all I needed to say, unless you have some questions or you want to direct it more specifically.
Now, there may be a question there.
Several years ago, Richard Kimmerer Jr. was the artist in residence here at Golden, and he's the one that did the ceiling, and there's some other stuff around here too. But he has started now, he and his family and friends, artist friends, have the art colony in Plains, Washington.
Grunewald, outside of Lebanon.
So he is trying, I think succeeding, to really revive liturgical art and or religious art.
Yes, he is. I'm from Valparaiso University, and I worked with Dick, and I know him very well. And Dick has a wonderful background in the fact that he couldn't speak until he was 18 or 20 years old, because he had many, many surgeries on his cleft palate. And out of sheer frustration, oftentimes we reach into another area to express ourselves, and he's always been into art, and this was his big forte. He is just a really great guy.
He's also written a book, which I was going to mention somewhere along the line as a resource, just one of them that we have. It's the resource that I found here in the library on visual art and the church. Visual art and the life of the church, encouraging creative worship and witness in the congregation. And his opening chapter is on the history. So if that does interest you more than what we've allowed for this morning, take this book with you and sign the card out first. Yes, the librarian will appreciate that.
And I'd like to add, I don't know if any of you are in processes of building churches. I haven't been involved in that, but I think there's a lot to be said if a new church is being built to take that in and consider that.
Hmm. And Richard Kimmerer helps on those kind of things.
They do consulting for sanctuary design, etc. Before completely leaving the history, there's one fact I want to point out because it affects us. It's one of the major changes from earlier days in church history to our world. The great age of the cathedrals, when they were building these, and the stained glass windows were a lot brighter than they are today. When you go visit them in Europe, you see them and they sort of this dull shade. In those days, they were very bright. Very clean, and the light just poured through there, and it was very brilliant. This was a marked contrast with a person's everyday life, which back then was a little bit toward the drab side. The colors were earth tones. There were, you know, buildings, your simple buildings, and the fields, etc. When you walked into the cathedral, it was sort of like an explosion of the senses. there was the, it had that impact on them, then all of a sudden they were in a very visual environment, more so than what they were used to. It struck them as a contrast. So they walked into the church and were visually stimulated. We live in a culture that is very visually stimulating. We have billboards and television, neon lights, a lot of clutter, too, in our everyday life, except up here at Holden. When we go into a sanctuary, into a church, we sometimes then want the opposite. We want a little bit more restfulness. We don't want to be, our eyes are a little bit tired. Our senses have been stimulated quite a bit. And sometimes we're looking for a little bit of a solace from that. And we want things a little bit simpler. We don't want a lot of loudness, a lot of noise visually. So it's not to say that we can't do a lot with color and stimulate the senses in a very dramatic way, but it's something to keep in mind as a major cultural or social change. I want to jump into some principles that I've come up with working with visual art. And you may or may not agree with them. You can take issue, argue, and that's fine, even if you want to do it here. And then get into some rules that I try to follow in working with visual art. And those may even be more controversial. And then some suggestions for you to take with you if you have an interest in getting involved in visual art in a very practical and hands-on way in your congregation. First of all, I think that visual art in worship is a collaborative art. It takes individuals' gifts, but it sort of pools them. The artist is working with the preacher, the other pastors, other members perhaps of the worship committee, and as I said yesterday, the source of inspiration for worship is the text, is the biblical text. That is their seed. And then they're opening up that word, they're discussing it, they're making it real to themselves, they're making it applicable to their local situation. In other words, they're doing some serious biblical interpretation and application. And the artist in there will let the word stimulate his or her artistic sensibilities, creative nature, and expand that. The word on the printed page is very limited, and one of the roles of artists in the congregation, and I'll use that term broadly for the moment, one of their roles is to lift it off the page and put it in different forms throughout the sanctuary to help those coming in to experience the word in different ways, ways without that are not limited to the printed text. It's also a very temporary art. I think for the most part, visual art in the church should be things that you see and then you don't see. Of course, there are always things that are permanent fixtures in most congregations. The altar, for the most part, is permanent in the pulpit, and there usually is at least one cross that's there and stationary. But the majority of the visual art in worship should be things that you see, perhaps for a season, at the most, and then you don't see. Not even again the next season, when Advent comes around again. Now, there's some people who I've read, who will say exactly the opposite, that things should be used over and over again. And I contend that it's better to start afresh and have Advent this year be different than Advent last year, have Easter be different this year than it was last year, to represent that our church year does not run us in circles, but it's like a spiral. And it's actually going someplace. We pass through the same, if you imagine a spiral here, we pass through the same point every year, but we're at a different plane. We're in a different place. Yes?
Yeah, I remember some of our members in the congregation, they like to see certain things again. They like banners we mm-hmm. make, and where did they go? What happened to mm-hmm. them? Mm-hmm. They would like to see it again, and you know, you want to accommodate other people too. Mm-hmm. Is there a right and wrong way?
Mm-hmm. Well, in my, these principles and rules I'm throwing out, I'm not going to put right or wrong on any of them. These are some personal preferences, and I run into that quite a bit, and do argue somewhat on this principle of temporariness. So you can do with it as you will, and hold it in tension with the voices inside of you that's saying, but I'd like to see that again, and see what creative comes out of that tension. Maybe you can come up with compromises, etc. But I'm just going to throw these out and stand by them. That yes.
To add to mm-hmm. that, I would like to support your view in the experiences that we've had in our church as well as other churches. There is a gentleman, an artist, liturgical artist called Reinhardt Reinhardt is his name. He's from Seward, Nebraska. He's a graduate from Valpo, and he's done a lot of liturgical art. And he has a book. He has a book out on banners, and he does some startling things. The congregation he belongs to must really hang loose. He does things that you've never heard of. He advocates paper banners to get away from this. Putting a good banner together is a lot of work, because I have made banners like this, and after you have spent $100 on a banner, you don't want it to hang in the closet forever. You want to bring it back out and show it. He advocates using brown paper, you know, the wrapping paper, and doing a banner that's appropriate for the message and so forth, and using it just one Sunday at a time. Roll it up and throw it away.
Recycle it.
Well, you throw away the paper in a different direction, but you don't take it back into church again. Because times change. The only thing that remains constant probably is what's printed in here, you know, the Bible text, mm-hmm. and the Sunday after Trinity, third mm-hmm. Sunday after Trinity, that remains. But mm-hmm. the people at large and the world at large continues to change. Mm-hmm. He's an advocate of change mm-hmm. within the banners. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes one is limited by finances. Banners are expensive. Mm-hmm. Ours have to be large in our church in order not to look like a postage stamp on the wall. I mean, you've got to be pretty big. Mm-hmm. And paper banners are even expensive these days. If you get colored paper, particularly brown paper, would be a little better. But mm-hmm. that has a lot of limitations. But I think, too, that we tried to figure out how we could use fabric banners and then incorporate them into mission quilts later. But that takes a whole other, that's a whole mm-hmm. other dimension, and everything has to be treated a little differently. But there's lots of restrictions on, I'm all for disposable banners. And I wish more people would come forward and say, I have an idea, you know, because we all have art. We all have that inside of us. It just has to be released. But it's part of the congregation.
Would you like to teach my drawing on the right side of the room? Because that's exactly what I say to everybody.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, they're sisters under the skin.
No, I don't teach anything. Not in banners.
Expense is one of the obstacles in having banners that keep changing, that are very temporary. Yeah. We'll get into that again a little bit when we talk about some of our resources, raw materials for visual art and worship. Another principle that I like to lift up is that visual art and worship is community art. It's a little bit different from, say, a painter's works, most of a painter's works, or a watercolorist, a photographer, and that they're created pretty much in isolation. There are exceptions, of course, but the basic pattern is an individual vision, and is something that, well, other people can take or leave. Now, some of the artists here may want to argue with that a bit, because you do have an audience in mind. But quite often you'll find a piece of art that hardly anybody likes. Nobody will hang it in their gallery or exhibit it. And yet it is still a powerful artistic statement. It is an important, maybe later the broader community comes around and accepts it. Visual art in worship is art that immediately involves and must connect with the whole community. There's not a lot of space for just individual statements. That means to me that an artist or a group, a committee, a visual art committee or the worship committee must keep in close contact with the congregation, with all of the congregation, and should have open lines of communication with them. How did this affect you? How did this make you feel? How did you respond to that? What ideas came to you? How did this help interpret the scripture to you? And they should know that they have a place to bring their feedback and their reactions. There should be a continual flow of communication going on. Now some rules that I like to follow. And these rules, again, you can take or leave. I see their purpose as getting us out of ruts. One of the main dangers in visual art in the church is to fall into a rut or a pattern. And as somebody once said, beware of ruts, they turn out to be shallow graves. The art loses its impact if it is falling into a category, into a rut. So the two basic rules I like to follow have to do with banners, although their intent is to get us away from restricting our concept of visual art in worship to banners, the most common art that we find in the church sanctuary. My first rule is to never hang a banner on a wall. On a wall, they are static. They are flat against the wall. They don't move. You can make them move. Okay, there are always exceptions to these, and I've even put a banner on a wall. But I try to follow this rule of never putting a banner on a wall.
Hang it in the air,
bring it perpendicular to the wall, use the ceiling, use the floor, use stands, use banners that are impossible to hang on a wall, that are just long stretches of fabric. If this rule helps stimulate your creativity, try to make it your own or promote it in your congregation of never putting a banner on a wall, just because it's too comfortable there sometimes. It's too comfortable for people, and it doesn't have the visual impact that art should have. Second rule is never put words on a banner. Again, somewhat controversial because that's the most common variety of banner. My reasons for these are that we already have enough words in church and worship, probably too many of them in most of our services. And so visual art, its domain isn't so much the verbal. It should accentuate its own qualities. It should take advantage of what it does best, which are nonverbal things, shapes, colors, designs. Textures. These are the materials of visual art. Leave the words to the sermon, to the reading of the scripture and the hymns, etc. Another reason is that visual art is to expand us, to open up our imaginations, to send us in new places. When we read words on a banner, we automatically think we understand. And so yes, I know what that means. Okay, I've heard that before, I've read that before. So we think we've encountered that banner. We've read it. We come in next week, if it's still there, yes, I saw that banner before. And we sort of dismiss it. We feel like we've come to the completion already of our experience with that banner. Images and shapes we can't quite as easily understand. And so we spend more time. I know I've gotten in trouble for this, but I sometimes have just purposely try to make people very curious and to frustrate them by not knowing exactly what something means. Because that means that they're active, they're interacting with it. And I try to praise them for that. When they express their frustration to me, I try to say, good. You know, something's going on. I'm glad that it's working.
Can I steal the mic?
You can steal the mic.
All right, I just can't sit still. There's so much talking about the two hemispheres of our mind. We have the left and the right brain. And the left side, we all have both, okay? For most of us, the world functions basically in the left. We're left-brained. The world forces us to be left-brained, which is where our logic is, our math, our reading skills, and also our verbal world is left-brained. The right brain is just the opposite. It has no words. There's no way to express feelings. It's timeless. We are caught into space. Since it's not mathematical, we don't have a time-space element. We have, let me see, what else do we have in that right brain? We use because we don't have language, we use our senses to take in the world, and all babies are born very right brain because they take in the world around them. They don't have language, and they take it in with everything in their mouths, and they taste it and swallow it and so forth. So anyway, translating that into what Phil is saying, you're saying that what we're doing on a banner when we put both words and visuals on it is that you're mixing up the left brain with the right brain. That means you're seeing it, we're all left-brained. I mean, most of us struggle as artists to stay in that right brain because the world keeps saying, hey, you got to be realistic, you got to balance a bank book, and we're pulled all over the place. And we'd much rather just bury ourselves in clay, right, or in sculpture or something and just forget the world. But we can't. Most of us cannot do that because we have other things that we have to take care of. But anyway, when you're mixing up the two, what we're doing is losing the creativity end of it, and we're unable to plug into what those symbols or whatever is up there is what it's trying to say to you non-verbally, because the verbal word is butting in and taking away from the meaning of the non-verbal. Do I make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And that's what you're saying.
I learned that the hard way.
Yeah. And that's the two sides of the brain conflicting with each other. And I can appreciate your thoughts on that because I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. At the same time, I don't want to give the impression that any banner that has words on it is necessarily bad.
Yeah.
I have seen some good banners that I've liked that have had words on it. And I've even done banners with words on twice. And both times they used the word Alleluia. And I figured that's not a very common usage word, so I could get away with it. And also I broke it up in several places so that you had to at least do some work to put the word together. I didn't want to make it too easy.
That's kind of a left-brain activity, though, isn't it, to put the word together?
Yes, it is. Yeah,
but at least it's work. I'm not against the left brain.
You see it visually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go. Uh-huh. That's a wonderful idea. Uh-huh. Yes. Using both sides of a banner. Creating the necessity to look at it from more than one angle. Right? Heaven forbid that we always look at things from one perspective and think we've seen it. Let's see. Where am I? Any other rules that you want to put forth and challenge other people with?
I have a little bit of a different idea going back to that. Do you think people naturally have a feeling for this time to react to a banner the way you would like them to react? Or do we need some more education on these things? For a congregation, for instance. You know, you would like people to get the fullest out of it that you maybe as an artist have put into mm-hmm. it, you know. You don't just do it for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a sharing thing, you know, and you said we should get the congregation involved and find out what we do about it. That's not always easy to do. Mm-hmm. You do that through the questioning sheet. I mean, we have enough meetings already.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that done? And my first question is, are we naturally all people inclined to be spoken to by a banner with our words?
Okay, what do some of you feel about that? Should there be some education about And the
I think that your art should be expressive to the individual without an education. Otherwise, you'll have to go into the left brain to get the message across. Mm-hmm. So your art should be not geared that direction, I think.
You have a very valid point, but we're also, I'm just going to be the devil's advocate here. We address this before we moved to Washington. We're from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and we were part of a new church and a whole new sanctuary. This was built about 25 years ago with an altar in the round, one of the first ones in Michigan. Very new concept. We had Kimmerer was one of our artists, and we had all kinds of wonderful things going on. Some of this stuff was not very well accepted. We have a piece of sculpture that never made it in, never made it into the sanctuary. It was assigned to the sanctuary. It always sat out in the hall, much to my dismay. But anyway, talking about what we did a few banners, and when we put out the brochure on the church, and this was given to all new members plus the people coming in who were, you know, part of the congregation, we had a description on what the symbolism was. You know, what this banner, it didn't have any words on it. The banners I do don't have words on them, but there was an interpretation of where the artist was coming from when they did this, and there was a description of all the different symbols, all the artistic things that we had, the cross and so forth, and the artist spoke. In fact, we made a tape, and I interviewed all the artists, and they had it on the tape. It went into our historical records. But anyway, and each person that came in as a new person got this booklet, so when they walked in, they could kind of, did you have a tour? On your notes, this is what they did. We took them for a tour through the church and explained to them what was there and why it was there. Now, whether they liked it or not was something else, but at least they had some handle on not only becoming familiar with that object, but they had some feeling for where the congregation was coming from. Because this is not just my decision, it was the committee's decision, as we mentioned before. So that was the way that we handled it, and each time a new banner came out, we would put it into the newsletter or into the Sunday bulletin, a short synopsis of what the meaning was and where the artist was coming from. Well, whether you buy into it or not, that's something else.
No, I appreciate that, because there's much of that I wouldn't understand either. But
yeah.
I'm a little bit too taken devil's advocate from her comment.
He's been doing this for days.
I know it.
Your earlier comment about the sixth sense was really pertinent in that in the discussion of the Gothic cathedral process, because that's what's operating there, is that the person is walking through the space and participating in the worship in the space. Mm. And it's a strong concept of being a part of the living word. Mm-hmm. Whereas you're talking about visual clutter of our culture, is it's all sign value. It's not, and it's very left brain visual orientation. So having a rich kinesthetic environment with a lot of things going on is not the same as having a lot of channels on TV. It's a different mm-hmm. sort of participation.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have the opportunity to be an element in the artwork,
right.
A part of the stimulation, not just being hit, not just being molded or pushed right. around visually.
And I think that kinesthetic sense isn't like an older sense we have compared to the verbal and written cultural things that are implied on top. So that by having someone participate physically, walking into the sanctuary and practicing their religion and worship and moving, subverts the text mm-hmm. of our culture that's coming mm-hmm. In on top of us all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me give one way that I dealt with this issue of whether to explain the art in the sanctuary or not. Because I too feel, that sentiment as a general principle. I don't like the necessity of having to explain art. At the same time, think that compromises are possible. And some people really need that. They're just, they need that encouragement. But anything said about it should be a little bit open-ended. so that it leaves room for them to go from there and it doesn't settle it for them. Once when I was hearing some comments about what does that mean, I'll try to remember what the artwork was. I don't think that I can. But I decided to do something up in the church newsletter, and I listened to a lot of comments that were coming about the art and what people thought it might mean, and then added some own possibilities of my own and created a dialogue between two people. I've been seeing this, you know, this season in the front of the church, and I don't, you know, no one's ever said what it's meant. And the dialogue just gets going, and they offer their suggestions. Well, I thought it meant that. Oh, well, that's different than what I thought. I thought, you know, this. And by the end of the conversation, there have been a whole lot of wonderful possibilities that were really, you know, theologically inspiring. And then I ended it by one person saying, yeah, it's just so confusing. I don't know what to believe. I just wish they would, you know, tell us sometime what it's supposed to mean, you know, with the idea of having people, by the time they get to the end of the conversation, realize that it had been explained. But all of these people's wonderings were an explanation for what it meant. Some of the things that come out of an artwork will be beyond what the artist may have intended, and that's as it should be. Sometimes some wonderfully powerful theological statements can come serendipitously like that.
It's also important that ultimately God is not knowable, mm-hmm. and that's where creative art can surpass the verbal and the mm-hmm. that it can hint at the mystery of God,
mm-hmm.
and that in some ways it can't be explained.
When Duff brought up the cathedral again, it reminded me of one of the principles I forgot to write down on my list here, and that's that visual art is environmental as opposed to illustrative. Do you have the list that I wrote out for you?
Okay. I gave it to you. Did you give it to Terry?
That's okay.
Do you have it?
There's something else. That's fine. Terry, don't go.
No.
Environmental as opposed to illustrative, and there was something else I was contrasting it to. It may have been educational. In the cathedrals, you know, the visual art was very educational. It depicted actual Bible stories. This was the Sunday school and in those days. People came, and because they couldn't read it in their Sunday school booklets or in their Bibles even, they got their religious education through the pictures. It was illustrative. It was other things as well, but it was to a large degree an illustration of the printed text. I see visual art in our culture and society today in worship more environmental, setting a mood, speaking to the right brain, not so much illustrating. I'm not sure how many, you know, depictions of shepherds and sheep or whatever we need. Those may be good, and they may be very powerful at times, so I'm not writing those off. But I think primarily its focus today should be on creating a whole mood or atmosphere, an environment, allowing things to take place, an environment for these stories to come alive, rather than simply illustrating the text of the day or of the season. Well, so much for rules and principles. I'd like to make some practical suggestions about perhaps where to begin or to start again in a local congregation. One of the things I find is helpful is to take a space assessment, a worship space assessment. And this you could do on your own if you're the only person interested, but it'd be better to get to other people who have a concern for the sanctuary together, and the artists in your congregation. And just walk around and sit in your sanctuary and look at it from new perspectives and take an assessment of what's there. For example, what are the givens that you're working with? This is your canvas, it's your clay, everything that you see. What are the possibilities and what are your limitations? limitations and restrictions aren't necessarily negative. They're sometimes what you need to get going. But what are the things that you cannot change? What's there and permanent? What wall can't you move? You usually can't change the height of the ceiling. Sometimes you can't even change the location of the altar. The windows sometimes are pretty stationary. So get an idea of what are the givens, the things that you need to work around or work with.
Sometimes the light is given too.
The light, the colors, you know, of the walls are pretty much the same.
The carpet.
The carpet, the textures. Also the things that are, for all practical purposes, givens. The things that you could physically move or change, but if you did so, would split the church. You all have things like that in your sanctuary. If you move this a little bit to the left, somebody is going to notice and be very, very upset. Make a list of those things where there are emotional, historical attachments that you daren't mess with, lines that you shouldn't cross. Or if you do decide you need to cross, something that you should do very cautiously and carefully and with a lot of preparation, because that could destroy your career as one of the workers in worship in your church, doing certain things. People will never forgive you.
Now in our church, we have a beautiful stained glass window on the front with a picture of Christ. And all along the side are those same stained glass windows. Now, when would you overdo it?
Mm.
You know, I mean,
so you're thinking there may be a little bit too much.
How much more could you add?
Yeah, okay. Well,
put your banner in the narthex.
We do have a banner.
Put them out. Put it out.
How
long has it been there?
It changes every so often, even for a wedding.
Okay, hold on to that question, because we'll be coming to that stage in just a second. If I forget it, stand up and holler. So, because that's not an uncommon problem. And let's see, also in that assessment, decide what is visually exciting or pleasing about your given situation, the givens that you have. What do you like, what works in worship, and what things are undesirable, the things that perhaps you'd want to hide, the things that are problems visually that nobody seems to like, and yet come up again as frustrations, or because they're permanent fixtures and people have gotten used to them, you just sort of ignore them, and they've already worn that rut into your mind, so you don't notice them quite as much. But a newcomer, a visitor coming into your church, sees it, and it has a negative impact on them. Those are important to notice. And then let all of these things affect your six senses and your emotions, and talk about how the space makes you feel. We might just do that for a minute here in the space that we're in. What are some of the qualities and characteristics of this space?
Has a high ceiling.
It has a high ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Natural treatment of wood.
Okay, a wood that's very natural. So how are you responding physically to that wood?
It's warm.
Okay, the color is fairly warm.
Not very exciting.
No, I have trouble with a lot of wood.
You have trouble with a lot of
wood. Yeah, because that takes a special approach to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
I rather have plain white walls.
How many people are wood people? Yeah, like wood? I think I tend to prefer wood in sanctuaries. How many people are stone people or concrete?
Oh,
stone
wow.
Or concrete?
Great.
Can't we be cool?
Natural.
Good question.
For contrast, you probably would want you know, contrast of smooth and rough, you'd want some plaster along with some. Kind of a combination. Mm-hmm. That's the best of both worlds.
Smooth and rough are two words. They're texture words, appealing to our sense of touch. Okay, what's the texture of this room? Pretty rough.
Rusty.
Yeah. It's
okay.
It's the altar.
This our, room has a special problem because there's a balcony and you can't, if you put banners in place hanging free, you're going to stop somebody's vision.
Okay. Depending on, you're right. That's one of the givens.
Oh, it's the ceiling.
You'd end up using your ceiling a lot and off from that wall. Remember, not on the wall, but
no,
off the wall.
A little off the wall. That's the way I like it.
There's already a lot of stuff hanging.
A lot of churches have that as one of their givens. There are a lot of lights hanging down and fans, so there's a lot of clutter.
Yeah, it makes it always easier for a simple design church in which we are. Except we have a brick wall. That's something always to consider there. Mm-hmm. But other than this, we do have space.
Mm-hmm.
It's not cluttered.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Also very hard to invade that space because mm-hmm. it's so tall,
mm-hmm.
high, and inaccessible.
What else is true about this room?
The thing that struck me when I come in here is some years ago when I was here, this was a fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having a Bible study in here, and there was also a fire alarm up. And that thing smoked, and the fire alarm went off, and we all went outside, and every other building, they were dragging out hoses. That's the kind of memory that I got from this place.
And that's tied visually with you to this room, so when you look at it, that's what you think of.
Yeah, and see the change now.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. What about this?
Oh, I always remember this song. We all can see each other. I like that.
Yes. I'm going to define that a little bit more. When I said this, I was sort of looking at our stone circle here in the center that used to be the circular fireplace. Okay. You saying
that?
I
like the eye contact that we can see all each other.
It has a practical purpose as a footrest.
Yes.
What does it do to our sense of congregation?
More community, maybe.
Community because of it,
it's
because
like
it's circular.
Sitting around a table at a meal.
Yeah,
that's round.
Yeah.
Okay.
When you say used to be, does that mean they no longer use it for fire?
Right. Right. It's no longer used for fire. Any problems with it?
Takes up a lot of space.
Yeah.
It's a little bit big.
You know, the problem that I have is that we use this for an altar, and it really bothers me that people put their feet on it. And I don't mean to be abrasive to anybody, because everybody does this. And I really have a problem with that. I have a problem with people putting their coffee cups on it. Of course, I know it's we use it for many things, and that's when it begins to lose. I have trouble with this in our congregation, too. We have a lot of young people in our congregation, and we have Bible class, or we have a summer Bible school, and we use the inside of the church part for dramatics. And she uses the altar as Noah's Ark. The kids are sitting on top of it. They are under it. And this really bothers me because there's a certain reverence. Now, I'm probably a real square, but to me, there's a certain reverence to certain religious pieces in the church, and this is one of them. And that bothers me there, and feet on here bother me there. I mean, don't take your feet down. I can live with that, but that's just where I'm coming from.
But mm-hmm. your feet have a very biblical place, the washing of the feet. Mm-hmm. What do the feet really do?
But but that's not the connotation here. We're sticking our feet up because they're tired. You know.
Well, apparently, when I've been here, it hasn't been like an altar. But
no,
like
I
this place.
Most people would never know that this is ever used.
I've never noticed it as an altar before.
Yeah.
Was
yeah,
it?
I guess I
did. Only people
who've
been to complex here would ever know that that's used.
Mm.
If this is an altar, what is that?
Well, but you have the symbols here that tell you it is.
There this
yeah. This cross is usually hanging up there, and it looks like it has fallen down. So, but I have seen it sitting there in the center in the sand, too.
Yes, I have, too.
So
and I've been here when we've used it as an altar.
The thing that I noticed about this is... When this thing was made, it was also made for different leg faints, and they got a place here for you.
Yeah. I want to point out a couple of things about our discussion just recently. Marion mentioned that what was going on with her emotionally when she saw feet up here because of her connotation of it as an altar. That kind of thing will be going on a lot in your sanctuary. One thing I'm remembering is that in one church we had this wonderful grand piano, and sometimes people would put candles on it. Now, there was one time in the history of the church, a long time ago, when wax dripped all over that wonderful grand piano, or I don't know about all over it, but it spilled over onto the surface, and it took some work to get that nice and shiny black again. So now, anytime there are candles on there, even if it's always well protected now, I mean, there are always things draping over that section of the piano, but that it's going to always be in people's minds who remember that wax. Even someone who's by nature worried about things like that, they'll see a candle and they'll think wax dripping. And they'll see that piano. So instead of that candle communicating whatever the worship leader had intended, it's communicating fear and worry. But now also notice what happened when Marion started that discussion. We started something theological going. You mentioned Jesus washing the feet of the disciples. Mm-hmm. And even when you said, yes, but we put our feet up there because they're tired, isn't that why one of the reasons Jesus washed the disciples' feet?
You're trapping me.
Those conflicts, don't always be afraid of conflicts. Sometimes a lot of creative things can come out of them. Treat them with care, but also treat them creatively. Right, okay. Somebody else mentioned, okay, if this is the altar, what is this back here? What is this? This is new. Last year when I was here, this wasn't up. And I really like it's what it does to the room. What does it do to the room? What is it and what does it do? This wooden screen behind the
I saw a couple of music
speaker.
Stands in front of it the first time I walked in here, and it immediately made me think how nice they've given, you know, musicians a stage, a place, kind of a visual.
Okay.
I don't understand. Why are there hinges?
It's temporary.
Put away, you mean?
Or even movable. If you wanted, whatever this is doing to the space here, creating a sense of focus and end stage, you can move it and do it elsewhere.
Put it in the corner. Or
right.
Anything.
Yeah. If you pull those out at a 90-degree angle, and it would make more of a smaller chapel like thing. If you put a table there with something on the table, all of a sudden you have a small chapel like Roman Catholics will have a chapel off.
Flexibility is a great attribute.
The ones from the Grünewald, they were really, you know, to open up. What are they called?
Triptych. Right there, yes. It has a very historical connotation too, the triptych. But what else is true about this screen?
It has different shapes. I mean, you see right away the lines. The wall is not just plain anymore. It's a dimension.
Okay. What else about it?
You have vertical lines in the back and horizontal lines this way, so you have a nice contrast visually.
Okay.
Very nice visually.
And it creates that cross.
Yeah, and then this cross, it only has a really good setting for the cross.
Yeah,
the cross
three
has all the lines in it. Yeah.
Three dimensions
to
the screen? There's something else very obvious. I haven't heard
it. It's the shelves. Yeah, I mean, you have availability of shelves.
It's very rough wood.
Shelves?
Not at all.
It's balanced,
finished.
But it's not bilaterally symmetrical, but it's still a balanced composition.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There's something else very obvious about it.
It's open and airy.
Aha!
Yeah.
I've walked behind the screen, and you can still see me.
Yeah.
Okay. What does open and airiness, suggest to you,
not
spiritually?
Confining.
Okay, not confined. It's very good for a small space because it doesn't. You still have the same size. Also, people are not very curious about what's behind here. Anytime you put up a screen in a worship space or you have some sort of partition or some wall, people are always wondering what's behind there.
Mostly
they want to cut up and,
Yeah.
That's not always negative because you can work with that curiosity sometimes. last Easter, it had the Easter banners surprisingly spring up from behind an immovable screen like that in the sanctuary where I was. So I used that people's curiosity, what's behind there, and to help create the element of surprise on Easter Sunday morning. Well, we're going to start running out of time here. You mentioned, what do you do with when there's too much already? Is anyone?
There's one more thought there.
Yes.
We have a beautiful altar, and then somebody in our church built a new, what do you call it, freestanding altar?
Mm-hmm.
And you can stand behind and face the audience.
Mm,
and we have
okay.
that sitting in front of us. I never did quite know that.
Mm-hmm. What do you do when something is already too busy visually? What can you want to? You can cover it, okay?
Yeah,
you can use a simple solid drape.
Your banners can be single colored things.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to have shapes on them.
Mm-hmm.
They can be a simple shape themselves, usually a long rectangle, but I mean, in our church they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're never square.
Perhaps like a scrim, a very transparent banner over a stained glass window might diffuse that and cause people to look at it for the first time. That stained glass window. I don't know, just any other suggestions?
How much authority does the pastor have in all this? I mean, how much do you have to consider? You might have no education at all in this. I don't know. Do they, when they go to seminary, do they get any education in they do?
Depends
well,
on
yes,
the seminary.
Yes, I think they do.
Okay.
I don't think it's very much. What we did, what the committee did, when we, I was chairman of our worship committee, and we had some the artist came in with his ideas and he shared with us, and the pastor was there, and we interviewed a lot of people and got a lot of information, and we learned together. And we seem to try, I mean, if you don't go all in the same direction in a worship committee, especially in a building, a new building, you have problems. And the pastor has to be plugged in because he's the one that is actually doing the worship service. And if this doesn't turn him on and he's turned off, then you've got that problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
not only, I mean, even if he doesn't say anything about it, he still is spiritually turned off, and that's bad news.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to work together very closely. And you do have problems if you have people that have really different ideas and they're not willing to.
Too much work to do.
Yeah, it's tough.
I'm only meeting to go.
Not easy.
Some will turn it all over to you and just say,
yeah,
go,
just take it
you know, do what
face.
You want. And that's not always good, necessary. But, yes.
I was wondering, you hadn't really said yet about, you're talking about going in and making an assessment and being, you know, leg workers and everything. But you haven't really said yet about doing it. You haven't been specifically, explicitly talked about working with a committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be good for a committee to do as a group.
I don't see how any one person, even the pastor, can do any changes.
Mm-hmm.
Because
pastors sometimes try to get away with it.
Working alone, you know, is liable to make a lot of mistakes, and it's just liable not to take into consideration another person's, you know, it may not even occur. A lot of the things that, some of the things that I do that upset people, I don't even understand it once they point it out to me, you know, because it's just not anything in my experience, and I would have never dreamed that would have upset somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But especially you talk about things in the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about what the woman said about the freestanding altar.
Okay, we're sort of out of time. I want to bring this to a close and then let the discussion continue. Is that okay, Eric?
Say, I mean, I came from a church where the pastor left after 3 years, and there was a lot of people who wanted him to leave almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that he did was put in a freestanding altar without discussing it. People showed up Sunday morning and there was a new altar.
That will do it.
He was doing from that day.
Yeah,
that will do it. It's a good illustration.
And that's tying to what you were saying about what explanations do you do about the art. If that would have been done through a committee, and if they would have educated the congregation about the important theological meanings that, you know, why you're having the pastor face the congregation instead of facing the cross while doing
changes. Changes must be done.
The idea that it was our pastor that did it. It was one member of our congregation that did this.
Yeah.
I never did.
You're reinforcing this point that visual art in worship is collaborative.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all changes to be done carefully. But just before you leave, I do want to mention that not only should you do a visual assessment of your space, but also an assessment of your artist. And that includes people working with cloth, fiber artists, seamstresses and seamsters, whatever the word is, quilters, watercolors, sculptors, teachers usually are good because they've worked with a lot of kinds of materials. You mentioned paper. Teachers do a lot of work with paper. Mine have some clues. Interior decorators. Don't just get stuck with certain type of person or certain type of artist because they can draw sheep very well.